The Capital Investment Committee will come to order. Representative Hansen, Lehman, and Considine have been excused, and we have two and two here at the table, so everything's fair, and we will note when the others come and save the minutes to the end. So the first thing on the agenda today is the legislative auditor's report on what wastewater infrastructure programs that our legislative auditor has done in 2019 or 2018 to 2019, right? And so I welcome Ms. De La Cueva.
Very good.
Okay, I've been practicing. And so thank you for coming, and thank you for narrowing down the report to the kind of base. We were given the report card from the engineers on drinking water and wastewater, and they had projections into the next 20 years and billions of dollars of costs that we have to address in the future. And so I thought maybe your report, with a special emphasis on wastewater, would be a reaction to that, perhaps, or just making a more precise prediction of what we have to do for future costs to meet the needs of the state of Minnesota in the next 10, 15 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good morning. For the record, my name is Sarah De La Cueva, and I'm from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. I'm pleased to be here with you today to discuss our Public Facilities Authority wastewater infrastructure programs evaluation. And this is a rare OLA report in that it was very positive. We found that PFA is doing a good job administering these programs, and we did not make any recommendations to PFA for improvement. We do make two recommendations to the legislature, and if we have time, I can discuss those at the end of my presentation. Before I get started, I do want to acknowledge Ryan Moltz, seated behind me, who worked with me on this evaluation. So I know that the division has already heard from the Public Facilities Authority about their programs, so I'll keep my background of discussion brief. But we did focus on wastewater programs. Drinking water and stormwater were out of the scope of this evaluation. If you're interested in learning more about the programs, I recommend checking out page 13 of our report. There's a table that compares them side by side. So just to give you a little bit of background on these four programs, the one we'll hear the most about today is the Clean Water State Revolving Fund, which the PFA uses predominantly to provide low-interest loans for wastewater infrastructure. The Revolving Fund is by far the PFA's biggest program, and it's partially capitalized by federal grants. In federal fiscal year 2018, Minnesota received $29.5 million in federal funding, and in order to receive that full federal funding amount, Minnesota must provide a 20% state match, which we have done consistently throughout the years. An important federal requirement, which is going to come up again later, is that PFA must manage the funds such that the balance is available in perpetuity. Point source implementation grants, known as PSIG, are grants for communities that need to update their wastewater treatment facilities to meet pollution discharge requirements. The Water Infrastructure Fund, WIF, provides grants to communities based on financial needs. And finally, the Small Community Wastewater Treatment Program offers both loans and grants to small communities that don't have centrally owned and operated wastewater systems so they can build one to replace failing septic systems in the area. So I wanted to comment on Public Facility Authority's performance. I'm not going to go through the funding process today, but I will tell you that we did find the process to be thorough and appropriate. It's a lengthy process, but each of the steps serves an important purpose in making sure that the good projects move forward. We did a number of activities geared towards testing PFA's compliance with state law. We conducted a file review of all PFA contracts in 2017 and 18. We evaluated PFA's policy manual, its application forms, the calculations it uses to determine grant eligibility, and we found no issues. We make no recommendations for improvement. What's more, PFA's responsible management of its programs has earned it a AAA bond rating from the major rating agencies. And PFA is really well regarded. We talked to lots of people, and no one had anything negative to say about PFA. We heard that PFA runs its programs like a bank, that it's transparent, that they're helpful and responsive, and do a good job helping communities through a complicated process. Not only does PFA do a good job administering wastewater infrastructure programs, but the programs themselves benefit communities. Not all PFA projects have measurable environmental outcomes, but as we discuss at the end of Chapter 2 of our report, projects designed to reduce phosphorus discharge were universally successful in bringing those facilities into compliance with permit limits. PFA programs save communities a lot of money. The Clean Water State Revolving Fund loans awarded since the agency's inception will save communities nearly $700 million in interest when compared with market rate loans. This is a conservative estimate because it assumes that all communities have the highest possible credit rating, which is not actually the case. So that $700 million is just interest savings. It doesn't account for any grants that the community may have received. And grants, of course, do help communities reduce the cost of wastewater funding. Looking at the 9 communities that received Clean Water State Revolving Fund loans in 2018, we calculated that PFA financing, including grants and loans, will save communities an average of 43% on their annual payments to the Public Facilities Authority. When a community builds wastewater infrastructure, the costs are ultimately borne by the residents of that community, often through sewer bills or special assessments. PFA's grants and loans can only reduce the cost of that new structure. Since the community's residents must continue to pay down previous wastewater debt and must also pay for operations and maintenance, the savings that a household sees on its wastewater bill is less than that 43% that we saw in the previous slide. This graphic shows a sample of the 2018 funding awards. And if you wanted to see all 9 communities that received awards in 2018, that's on page 35 of our report. In both cases, the teal dot on the left shows the per annual household wastewater costs with PFA financing, and the gray dot on the right shows what the costs would have been had the community financed the entire project with a market rate loan. You'll see that households saved from a few dollars a year to a few hundred dollars a year, depending on their combination of grants and loans that they received. So now we're going to talk a little bit about that 20-year funding capacity that Chair Murphy was discussing. And that report from the Civil Engineer Society, if you look in the sources, one of their sources is the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's Future Wastewater Needs Survey. And that is a source that we spent a lot of time discussing in our report in Chapter 3. So we found that PFA estimated $5 billion in wastewater needs over the next 20 years, and that aligns pretty well with what the civil engineers said. We discussed the limitations of that estimate in Chapter 3, and we suggest you take it with a grain of salt, but it's sort of the best estimate that we have to understand whether we can meet those needs. So that's what we used to estimate PFA's capacity to fund over the 20 years. I would like to note that not all projects will request PFA funding. Some will be funded locally. And so looking at just the segment of projects that intend to seek funding from PFA, that's $3.9 billion. So that's what those two columns represent on this graph. For our analysis, we assumed that the state and federal funding will continue at recent levels. You can see a chart of our assumptions on page 52 of the report. And that explains for the Clean Water State Revolving Fund in particular, these annual and total funding amounts assume that the federal funding and the 20% state match will continue at least at 2018 levels. And it also assumes that market conditions remain stable and that PFA continues managing the fund responsibly. For the other programs, we use the average of the last 4 years' worth of state appropriations. So using these assumptions, we estimated that PFA can distribute about $3.5 billion in loans and grants over the 20 years. This amount would allow us to fund 69% of the state's $5 billion long-term need, or 89% of the costs of projects for which communities intend to seek PFA funding. I would like to, unless there's any, do you have any questions about this? I know that was a topic that you were particularly interested in. But.
No, I think your clarification is helpful. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Then I'll move on to just my two last slides deal with recommendations that we have for the legislature. In calculating PFA's capacity to meet those 20-year state wastewater needs, we did not incorporate direct appropriations that the legislature makes to particular communities. These appropriations have fluctuated, and until recently they were fairly small in number. But during the 2017 and 18 biennium, there was quite a jump. The legislature made 8 direct appropriations each year, and that totaled $27 million, which accounted for 11% of all of the funding that PFA received for wastewater during the biennium. And these direct appropriations circumvent PFA's process, which I've already said we think is a good one. We found that almost half of the 2017 and 18 direct appropriations would not have qualified for a Clean Water State Revolving Fund loan had they gone through the traditional process. So this leads us to our first recommendation to the legislature. We just, since the PFA has a good process and they're administering it well, we recommend that the legislature exercise restraint when making direct appropriations to allow the communities with the greatest needs to rise to the top and get their funding.
In other words, that means?
We would suggest limiting the number of direct appropriations. We discussed in the report that there certainly are circumstances where it might make sense to do so. For instance, if there was already a major transportation project planned and the road was going to be torn up, so it was a good time to replace the sewer pipes, then it might make sense. But in general, we suggest allowing the PFA process to run its course.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our second recommendation for the legislature relates to a statutory provision that we think is ambiguous. Minnesota statutes state that loans from the Clean Water State Revolving Fund must be made at or below market interest rates, including interest-free loans. That wasn't right. When PFA makes its loans for wastewater grants, it does not actually allow the loan's interest rates to drop below 1%. And the agency staff explained that offering interest-free loans would imperil the agency's ability to maintain the fund in perpetuity, as is required by federal law. They believe, however, that they are meeting the requirement to offer interest-free loans because they do distribute some Clean Water State Revolving Fund dollars to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and other state agencies. And those agencies use those dollars to make interest-free loans through other water quality programs. We think that it is not clear whether the statute should apply to those other state agency programs or whether the statute was intended to apply to PFA wastewater programs. We recommend that the legislature clarify this provision in statute. If the legislature doesn't have a specific intention regarding interest-free loans, we suggest simply making the statement permissive rather than prescribing that interest-free loans must be required. If the legislature does want interest-free loans to be on the table, we suggest specifying the circumstances under which they should be made available. And that concludes my remarks for today. I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming. Do you have language prepared that you're suggesting to the legislature that they could use to change or clarify?
Madam Chair, I do. Allow me to find it. On page 35 of our report, 31 of the report, we discuss this recommendation. And if you do just simply want to make it a permissive requirement, allow things to keep going as they have been, we think that this language could be changed to loans must be made at or below market interest rates and may include interest-free loans rather than including interest-free loans. So we show the strike through and underline on page 31.
Any further discussion or questions?
No.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I happen to be on the OLA Commission, and again, just the glowing reviews for this specific PFA program and all that they do. And I think it also highlights what the legislative auditor's office is capable of and how helpful they are in being able to, you know, do such a thorough analysis of this and really come out with small positive recommendations that just provide clarity down the road. And I'm just overwhelmingly impressed with both institutions because of this specific report.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. De La Cueva.
Thank you.
We appreciate this, and we'll consider the, we'll review the report individually in more depth, and we'll keep page 31 in mind.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Freeman, do you have any reactions that you'd like to share with us at this time? Or not? You don't have to. But you're very welcome.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members. And I don't have anything specific. I thank the OLA staff for a very professional and thorough review. They've started meeting with us, I think, back in April, and spent a lot of long days looking through project files and documentation, and we had numerous meetings to go over various questions and issues, and they did a very thorough job. You know, I would just point out that in terms of the 20-year needs numbers, those certainly are big numbers. There's no doubt about that. But it's important to recognize those are over 20 years, and we're not going to deal with all of that in a short-term period of time. The projects aren't ready in a short-term period of time. It takes you know, a continuous, steady, predictable funding to allow the cities, and ultimately the cities are the ones that that own this infrastructure and have to do the work to identify the projects and bring them forward. And really the best way to keep that pipeline, if you will, of projects moving is for the cities to have confidence that the funding, the low interest loans, the grants, if they're eligible, to understand how the grants are determined. And that's really what cities need, is that predictability so that they can make their investments in the upfront engineering to keep those projects moving and bring them forward as they're ready. So it's a long-term problem or issue to address, and will require consistent long-term funding to keep it going.
Message heard. And thank you and the staff at the Public Facilities Authority for working so cooperatively with the cities and the people that need assistance, and walking them through the governmental process of getting a grant and or a loan or a position on the rating scale. That's very important too, and so to have this good report lauding your accomplishments, their work is much appreciated also.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Salke, or Representative Salke.
One of the things, thank Ms. Chair, one of the things that, and I don't know if this should be put off for another time, so please use that as a possible answer, because it could be just too much to talk about in this context, but one of the exposures I think we have are the very, very smallest treatment systems that we have around the state. Some could be attached to a disconnected mobile home park. Others could be attached to a other kind of gathering of residences, but they're not necessarily under the auspices of a incorporated city or a village or that sort of thing. Do you have any sense at all if we get to that very small sector, do we have available programs? Because I was so impressed last year, I think, when you went sort of through that whole catalog of possible places that cities and or entities can plug in and that you have programs that you can administer on their, for their benefit. So where are we in that arc of, I think of it as risk exposure versus the ability to respond to that?
Mr. Freeman.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think we have a, my thought is we have a good range of programs to address a variety of sizes of communities, and there's no doubt that the financial challenges are much greater for small communities, and then when you have the kind of, in some cases, even non-municipal type right. systems that you're talking about, they're all quite challenging. We have done numerous projects over the years to extend municipal service from a larger city to connect various areas like that and unsewered areas where there's a cluster of failing septic systems and that kind of thing. And we continue to do that. We also work really closely with USDA Rural Development, which is the federal agency that also has loan and grant programs and, of course, specifically focuses on small rural communities, and we coordinate with them quite often. And so for the most part, I think we, the Pollution Control Agency and the Health Department, have done a good job of identifying where those places are. We coordinate with the other funders to determine kind of what the appropriate way to fund those projects. Unfortunately, even with significant funding, they can be very expensive just to operate and maintain that infrastructure, as well as there's always some debt component, loan component. And so for residents that go from paying very little for wastewater treatment to now they're on a municipal system, it can kind of be a shock sometimes. And so there's some difficulties involved there. But I think we've got a pretty good range of programs to address those, and we take them. They usually take more time to put together and can sometimes take a number of years to sort of determine what the best solution is. But there is a path for those communities.
Thank you.
Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Freeman, just clarification, just the loan portion of the PFA funds, how was that originally appropriated? Was it just an appropriation from the legislature?
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Juergens. The Clean Water State Revolving Fund started under federal law in the late 1980s. It was a replacement of the old federal construction grants program that used to be strictly grants for community wastewater treatment. The way it's designed is the federal government appropriates through EPA an amount each year for capitalization grants that go to each state, are allocated based on a formula, and the state is required to provide a 20% match to the federal dollars, and then they come into, we draw them down, and as I said, it's an annual federal grant. We request the state match dollars as part of our biennial bonding request. But all of the, under federal law, all of the loans that we make, the repayments come back and revolve within the fund. We're not allowed to do anything else with those monies. PFA also has authority to sell revenue bonds, and that's the AAA rating that Ms. Del Cueva mentioned. And so we can sell PFA revenue bonds to leverage those funds and generate some additional loan capital. And then, but then all of the loans and interest repayments, interest rates last year were actually for the last several years just a little bit over 1%. Those come back in and then are available for new loans. The clean water, the wastewater loan fund currently has capacity of about $95 million a year, and the drinking water side is about $40 million per year.
Mm-hmm. You anticipate, thank you, Madam Chair, you anticipated my second question, mentioning the revenue bonds, and so you could actually grow it. My next question then is the local, the municipalities, is there a matching that's required of them when they take not the grant portion but for the loan portion? Do they have to match any funds, any percentage?
Madam Chair, Representative Jurgens, no. We provide 100% financing of the project. So if we can do the loan for the full project amount, and typically that's the way it works. If the city's eligible for some of the grant funds, the WIF or the PSIG grants, or perhaps grants from some other agency, then that gets just subtracted and we make the loan for the balance.
Okay, thank you. And I know that this program was very helpful to the city in my district in Afton when they were redoing their village area, and so I thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Friedman.
Thank you.
Representative Olson, Mayor Larson. Oh, I'm Mr. Ritchie. Welcome to the
Good morning,
Capital Investments Committee, and we're prepared to listen about the seawall.
All right. Good morning, Madam Chair and members. We're just getting the PowerPoint set up, but I'll get started. So House File 184 is our request for state assistance to complete Phase 2 of seawall reconstruction at the Duluth Entertainment Convention Center. Phase 1 of the project is currently under construction with non-state funds. There was some urgency in proceeding with the work due to cleanup contaminated sites along the St. Louis River estuary. One contaminated site was in Minnesota Slip, and we needed to make sure that the seawall was sound as the work proceeded to cap the contamination at that location. I have with me Mayor Larson from the City of Duluth, who can tell you a bit more about the urgency for completing this work. It relates to the severe storms that we have had on Lake Superior in the past year.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Murphy, and thank you, Representative Olson. My name is Emily Larson. I serve as the mayor for the City of Duluth. It is really a pleasure to be here today. Thank you for having me. And thank you, Chair Murphy, for hearing from us regarding the seawall at the deck. Representative Olson is correct. There is significant urgency surrounding the completion of this work. In the recent storms that have done such severe damage to the lake walk in Duluth, we have experienced a significant storm surge, which has raised the water levels in our harbor by several feet. And this has put a strain on an already failing seawall system at the Duluth Entertainment Convention Center. The work of repairing the seawall will be significantly easier and less expensive if we can accomplish it while the current structure is still in. If sinkholes begin to develop or sections of the wall become structurally compromised, costs will only rise with time. The seawall at the deck serves as the city's front porch. There's a great deal of activity in this area, so the timely replacement of the wall becomes a public safety issue as well. In the months leading up to the reconstruction of the seawall in Minnesota Slip, a significant stretch of the seawall was fenced off to prevent pedestrians from getting too close to the compromised seawall structure and the sinkholes that were forming. We appreciate the opportunity to be here. I'd like to just talk through a couple of slides, if I may. Chair Murphy?
Please proceed.
Great. Thank you. So I'm not actually going to read everything. I just wanted to show you a couple of things. So this is obviously an aerial view of Canal Park. This is the seawall area of concern in question. There's really two strips. The side that's on the right is the phase one. That's the phase that we're currently doing. The red line along kind of that bay side is phase two. I think all of you know Duluth. You understand that we're a city of 86,000 residents, 35,000 daily commuters, and 6.7 million tourists. And many of those tourists come to us because of the lake, because of the water. They want to get there. We have a lot of events which rely on the stability of the seawall. These include Grandma's Marathon, the Inline Marathon, tall ships, research vessels, military vessels, excursion boats, Bayfront Festival Park, Bentleyville, and the Great Lakes Aquarium. So we have had detailed engineering and inspections and investigations done. What we know about this area that is concerning is that it has several issues that involve safety, corrosion, failing wood cribs, failing 1880s platforms and docks. We have sinkholes. This is an anchor side for the Minnesota Slip Bridge, which is that blue pedestrian bridge. We have failing sheet pile, and we do have a strong need for environmental dredging in that area. And as Representative Olson said, phase one did address some of that. So phase one, which again is that element that has that Irvin ship and a little marina there, the shorter section in red, that is the section currently underway. $6.7 million is the project budget. It was an area that was built between 1880 and 1950. Those are the age of the seawalls there. The total budget is $7.8 million. The city investment, which is significant, was able to leverage a non-state funding to get that first section done. It will be open in the summer, actually. So maybe you saw the Irvin get moved out of the bay. It was pretty exciting for all of us in Duluth. It's going to get moved back in. And then section two, I purposely am not talking through the slide because I know you can read, and so I just kind of want to give you the visual there. This is the section that we're talking about. That is the area behind the deck and the area by the Great Lakes Aquarium. This is a $7 million project. $6 million of it is the deck wall. $1 million of it is basic surface improvements. It's an area that was built between 1950 and 1980. So I just have a couple of photos, and then my comments are done and would be happy to take questions. So this is the area behind the deck. So we have wooden seawall elements. We have metal seawall elements, all of which are failing. And then we have some significant, this is the area behind the Great Lakes Aquarium. As you can see, the seawall here is actually just kind of on its own, doing its own thing. And then, of course, we have storm damage that exacerbates the issue and really elevates the vulnerability and the access to sinkholes. These are some drawings of what it may look like when we're complete. So the surface, as you can see, there will be an investment in the surface element, but it is not extravagant, and it's really a connectivity issue there and a road access issue. So, Chair Murphy, that completes my comments.
Thank you, Mayor Larson. When did this start to be called the seawall?
Chair Murphy, thank you for the question. I'm in my fourth year as mayor, and I've always called it the seawall. And it was called the seawall before I was elected. So I don't know when that phraseology began, but you must know it by something different.
I didn't know it by something different, but lately I've heard about the seawall, and I thought, what are they talking about? At first that was my reaction, and then I was informed what they were talking about. And then when the Irvin moved, there was a lot of talk about the seawall, and I thought, when did we start thinking about it as a seawall?
I don't know.
Why not the lake wall?
I guess it's an inlet. Chair Murphy, it's an inland sea, I suppose, so we could take it that way. And our latest storm had hurricane gale force winds, so.
And then is there a third phase then for where that other end of the lake walk, where the underpinnings are really terrible? Is that part of the phase two, or is that a separate phase?
Chair Murphy, the section that is closer to the deck or the section that is further up the lake walk?
Up the lake walk.
So that is actually part of our, that's another storm that we're recovering from. And just last week we were notified that we did receive presidential declaration for FEMA. That's an $18 million damage that we have had there. And so we are beginning work. We've actually got one section that we will have done this spring, and I have invited delegation members to come up and see it, because as we rebuild those sections, not only are we looking at how to get people on a lake walk and moving and surface, but we're rebuilding engineering and structurally underneath and rebuilding with climate adaptation so that we don't have to do it next year when we have our next 100-year storm.
Very good. Very good answer. And I'm sure that federal money will be a tremendous asset. And we are most appreciative to hear of the notification that we qualify for, that you qualify for that tremendous investment in our lake walk and seawall.
That's right.
Huge.
Any questions? Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome to committee, Mayor. And a couple of questions. First, as I recall, there was some mystery about the deterioration of the seawall or harbor wall or lake wall or whatever this federally funded wall might be. Did that get solved? Did we figure that out? The steel was actually disappearing, and they were having some challenges figuring out what was happening.
Chair Murphy, Representative Torkelson, thank you. Thank you for your question. I looked puzzled at first because I was trying to remember which element was in question. And, yes, we have gone down and investigated. Scuba divers were down there doing all of the work that they needed to do. So I could follow up with you with more detail. We have a lot of information and evaluation on what was happening, how fast things are eroding, and what the critical points and junctures are. I think the area in question that you bring up is kind of the corner area where the Vista excursion boat, there were some really significant sinkholes there. Actually, we had to cordon off a significant area, so I think that might be the area in question, but I'd be happy to follow up with you with greater detail.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mayor. If it was – I do recall it was a significant problem, and I don't recall if they figured out how to solve it, so hopefully as we – continue to invest in the walls around the estuary that we have figured that out. Could you talk a little bit more about the federal funding involved in the first phase and potential for federal funding of this second phase?
Mayor Larson.
Thank you, Chair Murphy. Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Yes, the first phase, as I said, was around $6.7 million. We went ahead with that project. The city put in a significant portion of funding so that we could leverage non-state dollars, like dollars from the EPA and others who could help us get that project done. It is a project that is pretty complicated. There are a lot of public assets there. There's a lot of public activity. It's a thoroughfare. It's a connectivity issue. And then there's also some private activity and some parking on the other side. So there have been a lot of people in the kitchen on that project. I'm proud of the fact that we were able collectively to get it done. We moved ahead with that as one recognition of the city's investment in the two-part phase one, phase two process. So that should be open. I'm not sure what greater detail maybe I could provide for you that might be helpful this morning.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mayor. I was just, you know, a little bit curious about how much, if you're pursuing federal funds for Phase 2, and what possible contribution might be involved.
Mayor Larson.
Thank you, Chair Murphy. Thank you, Representative Torkelson. In terms of the contribution from the city, we would view that our significant investment of around $1.9 million into Phase 1 is representative of the investment that we would make to the total project. We can talk about what, in addition, we would need to do for Phase 2, but that is partially how we're positioning these two projects together.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we'll see how these potential sources come together. The Minnesota slip itself that we're spending, you and the state of Minnesota and federal funds are going into. What's the payback on the Minnesota SLIP?
Mayor Larson.
Chair Murphy, Representative Torkelson. Well, the payback to me is several fold. We have a few options when it comes to failing seawalls or harbor walls or lake walls. We could fill it in. We had serious contamination in that area. And so, because of course, as you know, the St. Louis River has been an area of concern. We have been seeking to get it delisted. It's in the way of, it's in process of achieving that, that demarcation, but in the meantime, there are significant remediation issues in the SLIP. So we really had two options. One was to fill it all in and pave it, and the other was to find a way to keep it open. I chose the path of keeping it open for a couple of reasons. One is it's a historical SLIP that has a lot of historical significance and meaning. It's a part of our history. The other is that I do feel very strongly that public access to water is something that we should work to maintain as a public entity. And so there have been examples where you could fill in a SLIP and privatize it or sell it or do things like that. There have been very strong feelings on the part of Duluth about the public access. And so we made the choice to cap it. We found kind of a hybrid model. There were options that would have brought it up to probably $18 million, I think. Just filling it in was actually quite expensive, so you still have to do certain things to stabilize, fill it in, cap, and do those things. What we chose was kind of a hybrid method, so we did cap it. And then we're doing the repairs, and then it should be good to go. We should not need to come back to that area again.
Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you, Representative Olson. Thank you, Mayor Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The Rochester item on the agenda is going to be transferred to another meeting in the future so that Representative Salk doesn't have to give the whole presentation by himself and give the people another opportunity to come to the big city. So the third item on the, or the seventh item on the agenda is the Humanities Center, the Minnesota Humanities Center. And they have a couple ideas to present to us today. Representative Mahoney.
You're going to be doing more talking than me.
But are you going to do the introductions? Is that it?
Thank you, Chair Murphy. Yes, this is a presentation on what we're going to be asking for when we have a bill and put it in front of you. So I want to thank you for allowing us this time this morning to the committee and to the chair.
You have our undivided attention.
Thank you. This is a request for $750,000. Last year, the bill included $1 million for renovations to the Humanities Center. We need to repair exterior and interior issues. Some is water mitigation, heating, ventilation, and air conditioning project. Work has to be done. The Minnesota Humanities Center is the old, it's located in the old Gillette Children's Hospital, which is in my district and abuts up to the Phelan Regional Park. Very, and for those who have been there, you know how beautiful the setting it is. For those who have not, you hopefully will get a chance to see it. You'll also see where my wedding was held, which is just about 2 feet, about 100 feet from the parking lot. Very, very lovely setting. Hopefully you'll go there when the magnolia tree is in bloom. The Humanities Center is confident that it can raise the match. It's a $3.5 million project. They need to have their match for the $750,000, and they're very confident that they can do that. Some of the issues, and I'll be pretty brief and then turn it over to the commission, or the executive director. There's water inclusion causing damage in the roof, the walls, and the interior meeting spaces. It's much more cost efficient if we do it all at once rather than use the $1 million that was there from last year and then come back and try and do it next year or whenever we can get the balance of the money needed. We need to clean up the mold that's in the building. And I will invite the interim president, Ann Hunter, to and the director, Nicole McMahon, to provide more information.
Okay, who goes first?
Who would like to go first?
I would like to go first.
All right.
My name is... Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ann Hunter, and I am the interim president of the Minnesota Humanities Center. Okay. Thank you, Representative Mahoney, for that overview, and good morning, everyone. Minnesota Humanities Center is the only statewide organization ensuring that the humanities are relevant and accessible to all Minnesotans. I'm joined by my trusted colleague, Nicole McMahon, who is director of our event center. It's part of the Humanities Center, and she's an expert on this historic building. In the next 10 minutes, I'm going to give you a brief history of the building and an overview of our mission-centric work. Nicole is going to talk about how we use the building and the pressing needs for repairs, and then I'll wrap up with a quick summary of the building costs and our funding model, if that's okay. And then we'll leave a few moments for questions at the end. There is a one-page flyer in your packets that describes what we're doing if you would like further information. So the Minnesota Humanities Center, our mission is building a thoughtful, literate, and engaged society. As a St. Paul institution, a nonprofit with a statewide charter, we offer programs and events throughout Minnesota, and we run a St. Paul-based full-service event center. We're also recognized as the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Unlike other academic institutions that study the humanities, we focus on public humanities, which means we bring literature, ethics, civics, history, philosophy out of scholarly institutions and into the everyday lives of all Minnesotans. Our historic building is located on St. Paul's east side. It was built in 1924, and it occupies the only remaining wing of the original Gillette Children's Hospital. The rest of the hospital had been torn down. That earned it a place on the state's Register of Historic Places. Fittingly, the wing that we're in is the hospital's old schoolhouse and library. Did you know that?
I did not.
And a good place for weddings. As you may know, the building had been abandoned and neglected for about two decades, before the Humanities Center raised $2.75 million, including more than $1 million in bonding from the Minnesota legislature, to convert it to a statewide event center. In 1996, after 22 years of what we would call couch surfing, basically we rented and borrowed space around St. Paul, we finally had our own space when we moved into the old hospital space. And that's when our programming really took off. The Humanities Center creates programs that explore the complexities of the human experience. What we mean by that is we engage Minnesotans in all backgrounds in five different kinds of programs. First is Veterans Voices. You may have heard about that. It uses storytelling and workshops and awards to amplify Minnesota veterans' experiences. We Are Water Minnesota examines the practical, spiritual, and environmental roles of water in our lives, just what we were talking about in Duluth. Our partners, we partner with four different agencies and the Historical Society in order to bring this traveling exhibit to towns and cities all around Minnesota. We have an active K-12 education program that builds on our education legacy through workshops and field trips that examine the manifold cultures across Minnesota. We like that language. Native Nations of Minnesota deepens our understanding of place through interactive websites, workshops, field trips, and the award-winning Why Treaties Matter exhibit, That's the one that's on permanent display at the Capitol. And then finally, community conversations engage people who are interested in exploring how the Manatees can unite us instead of divide us. That's a quick look at our programs. These programs are centered on four core values: build and strengthen relationships, learn from and with multiple voices and communities, amplify community solutions to change, and recognize the power of story and the danger of absence. We call that absent narratives, and it's a through line in all of our programming. We ground these values in the philosophy that the community leads and we follow. Last summer, we held 11 listening sessions in 10 communities around the state. This summer, another dozen are planned. And that feedback not only informs our programs, but it affirms the importance of our network of statewide partnerships. Since 1971, which is our year of founding, we've had thousands of partnerships across the state. I'd like to now turn the podium over to Nicole, who's going to walk through our asset preservation project.
Thank you, Anne. And for the record, my name is Nicole McMahon, and I'm the Event Center Director at the Humanities Center. I'd like to start by telling you a little bit more about our building. It's actually owned by the City of St. Paul, and we have a long-term lease with them. The Spanish colonial-style building was designed by St. Paul architect Clarence Johnston, and it houses many unique decorative features, including carved tiles and whimsical sculptures. As Anne mentioned, in 1980, it was designated by the City of St. Paul as a historic property through the Heritage Preservation Commission. Without our presence in the building, it would have to be maintained by the city. The event center includes 5 meeting spaces, 15 overnight rooms, a commercial kitchen, and is a business-generating facility for the St. Paul's East Side, bringing in both state and national clients who patronize local restaurants and businesses. We have about 350 events every year and see 10,000 people through our doors. As Representative Mahoney mentioned, the building is in urgent need of repair to stop the ongoing damage of the water intrusion and to replace an outdated HVAC system. To ensure a safe environment for both our staff and our visitors, we need funding for the following projects: $340,000 for exterior building repairs. This is to help stop water intrusion, preserve the historic character of the building, including repairs to the roof tiles, stucco, cast stone wall caps, replacement and repair of the parapets, and painting of the exterior soffits. In case you need further evidence, this is a piece of stucco that fell off our building last week with a cold front.
I came in the side door, thankfully, that day, because it's right in our front entrance.
We've been very lucky to never have stucco fall on any of our 10,000 guests. It tends to happen overnight, so I'm thankful for that. I've been with the Humanities Center for 15 years, and I've literally seen the building fall apart in my time there, and it gets worse every year. In the last 5 years, probably have been the biggest progression of that I've seen. Next, we need a little over $1 million for groundwater mitigation. That includes waterproofing. Oh, there's the picture of our broken stucco that fell off. $1 million for groundwater mitigation. That includes waterproofing the foundation, rebuilding retaining walls, redoing our basement slab, adding some interior drain tile, and all of that to stop the water intrusion at our garden level. Lastly, $2.1 million to replace our HVAC system, and that will help us reduce moisture in the building, eliminate mold, conserve energy, and provide a comfortable environment. Our current system is basically on or off. There's no temperature controls, there's no thermostat, and it's nearly 25 years old. As you might guess, these costs exceed our annual operating budget, and without financial support, we can't continue to stay in the building. If we do vacate the building, it would need to be maintained by the city, and we'd have to restructure our whole budget, including our office and off-site venue rental. That would dramatically cut into our resources that we have for programming and would have a profound impact on the way we operate in the communities we serve throughout the state. With that, let me turn it back over to Anne.
For the record, this is Anne Hunter, interim president. To recap, our asset preservation project relies on $750,000 in additional bonding, which we will match with local funds. We have already raised more than $1 million in matching funds for the 2018 bonding allocation, and that includes $350,000 from private funds and $590,000 from local foundations. In addition, we've secured a $250,000 STAR grant and loan from the City of St. Paul, and that's tied to water mitigation. That grant and loan expires in 2 years, so that creates more urgency for us to act this session before we lose that funding. That wraps up our prepared remarks. We appreciate your interest and your past financial support, and we're happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you very much. Please clarify for me. I'm a little confused.
Certainly.
You have just one building.
We have, yeah, Madam Chair, we have one building, and it serves two purposes. It houses our headquarters, so our offices for 30 staff, and we have about 300 contractors, and it functions as an event center. It's a shared building. The event center generates about $400,000 a year, and that basically covers the cost of us operating there.
Okay, and the building is owned by the City of St. Paul. And what kind of oversight does the city have for the building?
I'm going to turn that to Michelle.
Yes.
Or to Nicole.
I get called Michelle all the time. Thank you for the question, Madam Chair and Committee. We have a long-term lease, a 50-year lease with the City of St. Paul, so we pay $100 a year in order to stay in the building. There, to my knowledge, there isn't a lot of oversight from the city. We've met with them before, and basically it's up to us, our responsibility to take on the financial part of that, and we maintain and upkeep, maintenance, everything of the building. That's part of our lease.
Okay, so they're hands off.
They're hands off.
You
correct.
$100 mm-hmm. a year. Okay, and who are you? The Minnesota Humanities Center, what is that? It's not a state agency.
Madam Chair, we are a nonprofit 501c3. We used to be a state agency. We were a commission, and many years ago we changed to a nonprofit. We have a statewide charter, and we are affiliated with the National Endowment for the Humanities. But we are an independent nonprofit that runs these programs.
Okay. And what does affiliated with the National Endowment for?
The National Endowment for the Humanities.
Yes.
So that they have a chapter, if you will, in every state. And so we are the state chapter. We get funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities. That's one of our major funding sources, along with the state of Minnesota, private funding, and earned income. It's just like any nonprofit, we have multiple sources of funding.
And do you get the same amount of funding each year from the National Endowment for the Humanities?
It varies slightly, but roughly $1.5 million per biennium.
Representative Erdahl.
thank you, Madam Chair. And first, Ms. McMahon, I want to commend you for bringing a chunk of the building here. I found in the past it's an effective tool in trying to get bonding.
I had a whole box full of them.
But you received $1 million in the last bonding bill. Have you been using that money? What has been happening so far? Any?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl.
Ms. McMahon.
We have started the process with Architectural Advantage. It's a firm. They've drawn up the preliminary for the project. We haven't moved on this. We have contracted with STAR Grant. That has to be used within 2 years. Our biggest dilemma right now is we don't want to start this project and not be able to finish it. To use our time and money the most efficient way, we want to have all of the funding for the $3.5 million up front so we can do this one time, do the whole project, because that involves losing earned revenue in the event center. That involves possibly relocating our offices. We want to use the best scenario possible, get everything right away, do it in the most efficient manner. So we've started the process to so we can continue it in hopes that we secure this. If we don't get this money, we can only do part of the project, and we have a plan B for that as well. But our ideal situation to be the most efficient with funds and our time, our building, everything, really relies on the $750,000.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. McMahon, I want to say that it was actually the intent of this committee in the last year to put in the other $700,000. For whatever reasons, sometimes things fall through the cracks at the end, and where we had intended to put that back in, it got lost along the way. So hopefully you'll have a better conclusion to the session this time.
Oh, we hope so.
And just in conclusion for me, I noticed that President David O'Fallon is not here today. He's retired, the longtime president of the Humanity Center. I'm sure you're aware you have big shoes to fill with him. Mm-hmm. But he did an excellent job over the years. He was inducted last year into the Litchfield High School Hall of Fame. So I'm sure
we've heard.
Realizing
we saw the plaque.
That great honor that he had achieved, he decided it was time to move on. But we'll miss him, and good luck in fulfilling his mission over the years.
Thank you.
Representative Pearson.
You mentioned it's a 50-year lease. Is the 50-year lease up at a current juncture, or are we 20 years out from that, or are we 40 years out from that?
Ms.
McMahon.
Madam Chair, Representative, we signed that lease in 1995. So it is up 25 more years, roughly.
Madam Chair, Representative
Ms. Hunter,
may I interject? It's a renewable lease, so kind of a moot point. We can have it as long as we are willing to maintain the building.
Madam Chair, I did notice that you have the option on it, so that's a positive thing, and again, that assumes that the programming and everything is sustainable, and mm-hmm. obviously with the $100 a month or $100 a year deal, that should be something that's an ongoing endeavor. But again, as a bonding committee, we have to look at something beyond 30 years, and if this building were to return to the city of St. Paul, it seems like we'd be doing state funding for a city asset. So that's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Narnas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you said that the building had been empty for some over 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Buildings deteriorate a lot. When you acquired or moved in, did the city of St. Paul bring it up to par so that it was livable, or did you have to do that? Because I assume that had a fair amount of work to be done to make it even how it appears in these pictures.
Madam Chair,
Ms.
Representative.
Hunter.
The Humanity Center raised the money and did the work. Teachers' unions pitched in because we do our education work. Foundations gave us support. The city worked with us to do those upgrades, but it was our organization that raised that money and restored the building.
The only reason I brought it up, the city of Fergus Falls, where I live, has a city-owned or former-owned, a former state-owned building that now the city owns, and it's only been empty about 10 or 12 years. And I was just thinking of whose responsibility is to fix it up so someone else can use it. But I understand that it worked out for you. That's good. Thanks.
If you are interested,
Ms. Hunter.
If you need another building, I guess I'm just talking.
In rural Minnesota.
Madam Chair, we do a lot of work out throughout the state, so we have locations where we work in partnership with communities, and so we might work with historical site, a Carnegie Library, a park. So we're always using those facilities, even though we don't own them.
Okay, thanks.
It's a real Downton Abbey, so you should think about it for the American literature, English literature programs.
Yeah. Without the great outfits, yes.
Right. I bet there's some outfits in those closets left over, I bet. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. McMahon, the City Star grant, I'm not familiar with that particular program. Can you just describe a little bit about that Star grant program and where those funds are generated and how they're awarded?
Sure.
Ms. McMahon.
Madam Chair, Representative, the St. Paul Neighborhood Star grant is basically from the St. Paul city tax. All that excess tax, I don't know if it's 2 or 3%, goes into a fund. And then this is actually our third year. We applied 3 years in a row, got the STAR funding. You can apply for up to $250,000 per project. And we have a mix of $100,000 grant and $150,000 loan. I said that right. But it comes from the St. Paul city tax that we pay. That goes into a fund, whatever they have in excess, that goes into their STAR program.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So you've had other allocations prior to this one from this same program? I didn't quite catch what you were saying.
Oh, sure.
Ms. McMahon.
Madam Chair, Representative, we got denied the grant the first 2 years. The third year we applied, we were rewarded.
Thank
Representative
you.
Torkelson.
But it's not fully a grant. It's only partially a grant, and the rest is a loan.
Correct.
Thank you for that information.
Anything else? Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Mahoney. And
Madam Chair, thanks for your time and your
Representative Udall.
I'd just like to comment that I think that Representative Mahoney looks particularly dapper today. Maybe you've got a TV appearance or something that you're addressing.
I'll be representing the legislature tonight on some television show, apparently, and I need to get home a little early so I can get changed into my work attire, you know, T-shirt and jeans and work boots.
Thank you very much
for
coming. The last item on the agenda is the minutes. Representative Sandstedt.
Madam Chair, I move the minutes.
As printed.
As printed.
Motion is that we accept the minutes as printed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are adopted. Is there any other business, any other conversation you want to partake in at this moment? Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the members, I just want to thank you for coming and expecting the good story of the airport project that we need. I have some documents that I had prepared that if you want to do a little homework kind of thing and see the project and see parts of it described, I have that available. I just didn't want to use that in context when they are going to come with their full project later and another thing. So I have that available if you're interested.
Thank you very much. Otherwise, please keep your Rochester folder in your safe pocket in your packet. Any further business? This meeting is adjourned.